Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for July 22nd, 2012. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Join me once again. Welcome, Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
And after a one-week hiatus, welcome back, Catherine Smith.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be back. Hello, everyone.
Oh, yeah. Well, big show this week. In just a moment, we're going to have one of our highest-rated guests ever from Peach Pundit. Charlie Harper will be joining us for another in a line of times. I guess it's still not so low we can't count it, but it's got so many that I just don't remember it off the top of my head. He's been here a few times with us. Later on, State Senator from Georgia, Miriam Parris, will join us in the second half hour, talk about her campaign for reelection to the Georgia State Senate. So they got a big show on that, and Charlie will be on any minute with us. Until he does, though, Catherine, we had a discussion last week about polling and cell phones and landlines. And since you're, you know, always on with us and you just happen to miss this discussion, I think it's pertinent. Catherine, do you have a landline or just a cell phone?
I have both, but I get my landline as part of my package with my cable TV, and I honestly never use it, and I don't answer it.
Yes.
Nobody's got the number.
Well, I mean, in the times that you have gotten calls, and maybe this figures in because you get it through your cable TV, do you ever get political calls or political polling through that line, or do you have any idea of knowing?
I have no way of knowing because I don't answer it.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I've never given it to anyone, so anyone who's calling me on that is going to be either a wrong number or someone trying to either sell me something or, you know, pull me. So I just don't answer it.
The cable company, yeah. Well, we were just discussing that if you have only use a cell phone, people that, you know, use cell phones exclusively seemingly never get polled, never get robocalls. And it's such a dynamic to think about when we look at a lot of this polling and age demographics and whatnot. Well, welcome back to the Kudzu Vine from Peach Pundit, Charlie Harper.
Good evening. How's everybody tonight?
Oh, doing well. Well, Charlie, thanks for coming on in. Hadn't had you on in a while. And with the Georgia elections just so close to us now, it just seemed like a perfect time to get you in since this is a lot of primary voting and you have a better understanding of the other side than we do. But
I can pretend here, but I'm not sure anyone really does.
Yeah, no, it's mean. But we will get into that partisan side of things. But first off, there's the one thing that's on everybody's ballot, and I believe it's going to be the only thing on my ballot, and I have to actually probably remember to go vote for it because it's the only thing on my ballot, and that's the T-Splost. Charlie, this idea seemed to, I guess, start out with a little bit of popularity, but it seems to be losing popularity quickly. In your opinion, and what you're seeing, what's going on with the T-Splost?
I think that's a good characterization of it. The important thing to remember about T-Splost, though, is that it is regional. And so in my world, most of the time when we talk about T-Splost, we're talking about Metro Atlanta T-Splost. There are parts of the state, I think, that will be received a little more favorably. I'll be honest and haven't done a really good job of going region by region. One of our contributors at Peach Pundit, Bill Dars out of Savannah, has actually broken it out by region in an attempt to do that. And so we've got a couple of articles online there to try to break out the other regions. But specifically in Atlanta, it started out a little bit behind the curve, but with a lot of institutional momentum behind it. And I think that's right at this point. While it's not dead, it definitely seems to be off the rails and going in the wrong direction for the people that wanted to get that passed.
Yes. Well, I'll ask a follow-up before I pass it around to Catherine and Tim.
What do you think's been the problem in keeping its popularity?
Well, you're basically asking essentially Republicans, because it's a July primary with very little region-wide Democrats on the ballot in the middle of July, to pass a very large tax increase. And so just fundamentally, you start out with a problem there. And then you have a problem of equity, in which almost everyone voting somehow seems to think that their particular part of the region is getting the short end of the stick. And that's true from the far out exurbs to the inner city, where you're hearing people saying, I can't vote for this because another part of the region is getting too much. And so there seems to be a perception that the return of what the individual that's being asked to vote for it is going to get is not going to get what they're going to contribute. Now, mathematically, that's impossible, but that seems to be very much a perception of how it's being handled right now.
Yes. Well, I'll go ahead and pass it around for more questions on the T-Splos, and I might even follow up on that. Catherine, your question.
Well, hi, Charlie. It's Catherine. It's nice to have you on the show again.
Glad to be back.
My impression of the T-Splost, you know, I started out supporting it because a lot of the people who I respect were supporting it. And I thought, okay, you know, 9% sales tax, whatever, because I live in Atlanta. But the more I look at it and the more I examine it, it seems like, and, you know, maybe you have a better sense of this, it seems like, to me, the main problems with transportation in the Atlanta area are getting people into the city and out of the city effectively and efficiently, and getting people around the city efficiently. And it doesn't seem to me that any of those things are being addressed, really, in a sort of, I mean, it just, that's the way it seems to me. And what is your impression?
Well, I guess at the end of the day, if people are thinking another penny is going to fix all of our transportation problems, regardless of what they are, it's not going to happen. So there's an expectations versus reality gap that starts for everyone, and the perception of what the problem is versus what the potential solutions are. And so to a lot of extent, you're correct. The traffic problems aren't as much inside the city, or at least aren't going to be fixed inside the city, because most of your transit solution or most of your traffic solutions inside the perimeter are going to be transit related. You don't really have corridors where you're going to be widening roads. At one point during the last governor's race, I think we had an opportunity, or I shouldn't say opportunity, but one of the ideas was to essentially either tunnel through East Atlanta, under East Atlanta, or, you know, directly through it and pave it over. But the reality is that's not going to happen. I mean, the Presidential Parkway, Freedom Parkway, took forever to get built and finally ended up being a very, very toned down version of what was originally planned, because you just can't fight. Residents versus traffic, residents generally are going to win. And so while everyone knows we need more roads, more paths, more transit, more rail lines, you almost have to go along corridors that already exist to make that happen, because you just have such a not-in-my-backyard NIMBY problem that you can't make it happen. So realistically, the problem is more out in suburbia, where sprawl, lack of zoning, lack of coordinated regionalism, whatever you want to call it, the problem's out there. The problem inside the city are much more targeted, such as how do you get people in and out of the Emory area, where all the roads in and out of Emory are two-lane roads for the most part. The Emory Rail was going to be a solution. How do you move people around? Well, Beltline, in theory, is a solution to it, but the reality is, if I understand it, Beltline's really going to be a bike path. It's not going to be a train line going around, because you essentially have a 12-foot right-of-way circling the city. I could be woefully uninformed on that. And personally, I'm not opposed to the Beltline. But you already have the Fulton and DeKalb taxpayer paying 1 cent to have the transit, to have this backbone of infrastructure. They're being asked to pay a second cent, while the suburbanites that really have most of the problem are only going to be paying a penny. And yet the suburbanites are using this Beltline as the holy grail of why they shouldn't pass it. Meanwhile, you've got the folks that are being able to now pay 2 cents are being asked to give up even more governance from MARTA. They're not being asked to, or they're being told basically they still can't get the restriction of how MARTA's money's spent. There's going to be no state aid. And at the end of the day, this comprehensive solution really is less than comprehensive, because it's still protecting fiefdoms. It's still protecting, shall we say, images and stereotypes of 20 and 30 and 40 years ago of what transit and traffic governance should be. And I think it's really crumbling under its own weight because this was a concept that was passed to get Republicans through the 2010 election, but there was an expectation that someone would come along behind it and actually tweak it to solve these problems. And frankly, all these problems aren't solvable, and they're certainly not solvable for the amount of money that this is going to take, because if you take a traffic wish list for the general greater Atlanta region or Georgia, you'd have to add at least 10 to this to really make a dent in it. And so when you start trying to divide $10 billion, which sounds like an awful lot of money, but if you have a project list that's $250 billion of wish list projects, and I've seen a number that high, you can only do so much with a penny. And then at the end of the day, everyone thinks someone else is getting more of that penny than they are, and half the people don't even want to pay the penny to begin with. It makes it really difficult to see how this is going to pass.
All true, and a very good perspective. Thank you. I'm going to pass it to Tim now.
Hey, Charlie, and let me do a little bit of quick housekeeping. Do wish our good friend Buzz Brockway a happy birthday from the country vine.
I will make sure that I do that.
All right. Listen, I live in an outlying county. We have a different perspective on the T-Splost up here. Even though we are the most Democratic county in the state north of Fulton, every elected official here is a Democrat. We are poised on the 31st to not only reject the T-Splost, but to reject it impressively. The voters, the average voter up here, has gotten the idea that they are being asked to vote themselves a tax increase for something that will actually benefit someone in another area and not them. Is that sentiment that the voters here have adopted a fair one?
Oh, man, the question of fairness. I've written on it a couple of times, but as my father always told me, nothing in this world is fair. And every time you subject the word fair into the political realm, I get even more scared. But with that said, that is what I'm hearing. And I've heard it from some places in South Georgia even. And frankly, I expect you to see it pass more in some of the more southern Georgia regions than northwest Georgia, I think, was the one that everyone said was doomed from the start. It's, I mean, if you just look at it, Tom Graves represents that area, and the constituents that elect Tom Graves, that we all know his opinion is different from the three of you, in that it's standalone. We don't need more government. He doesn't even want the, you know, federal transportation motor fuels tax to continue. You know, it's a let's keep it at home, let's do it ourselves, independent people kind of group. So I wouldn't expect Northwest Georgia to have passed it to have begun with, but this really was set up as a way to get transportation dollars from Metro Atlanta to stay in Metro Atlanta, because traditionally during the old days of county unit system, where even as Metro Atlanta became the dominant population center, the political power was mostly in South Georgia, and economic development equated to more roads. And so we four-laned so many parts of this state to get you from nowhere to nowhere where nobody lives. And I apologize to people in South Georgia for saying that, but that's just, unfortunately, when you're an Atlanta person, that's perspective that Metro Atlanta has. And so while South Georgia equates more money going into roads, meaning more economic development, more vitality, more projects, it doesn't mean that in the minds of a suburban voter. That means more sprawl, more developers taking advantage of the system, more taxes we put into something that we have no control over. And so you do have a perception difference. And so while I do expect it to pass in some of the South Georgia regions, I think the Savannah region is generally looking okay. But again, I could be wrong on that. I'm just going off some offhanded comments rather than any, shall we say, that's more anecdote than data. But I do know that there is a definite difference of perception of what dollars for roads mean in South Georgia than they do in North Georgia. And there's also the difference of the local component, where if I'm not mistaken, 25% of the money stays in the local county where it's raised, everywhere except Atlanta where it's 15%. And so you don't have as much of the regional quarrel in some of the other areas because more of the money staying at home could be determined by the home counties that the money is raised. And so this really, like I say, was a construct designed to try to figure out how to get Atlanta, which produces the vast majority of the state's income tax, the vast majority of the state's retail sales tax, to stay within that region. They then just created the other regions to kind of balance it out and make sure money, you know, had a venue to go elsewhere if people wanted it. But Kyle Wingfield and the AJC, I think, was one of the first ones to write in column, okay, what if all these other regions pass this and Atlanta doesn't? Then you've got the Atlanta region being penalized by the local match on top of the fact that they're not putting the extra money in, and now the state leaders have a real problem because the whole rest of the state is funding transportation, pulling even more local match out, and the city of Atlanta goes even further behind because all of our leaders and all of our civic business community leaders have all pulled together to say there is no plan B, there is no viable option. And so how on August 1st, if this thing is defeated, do the Atlanta region folks pop up and go, okay, there really is a plan B, and this is what it is?
Well, would a unified state vote have been preferable then to affect everyone equally?
Well, herein lies my problem with the whole concept, and it's in the fact of having to put this before the voters. At the end of the day, we elect leaders to lead, and continuing to punt problems back to the voters is not leadership. It's obfuscation of, I want to keep my, I didn't raise your taxes while I made you raise your taxes pledges, and
yeah.
I don't really see how that serves anyone.
That is an excellent response. Thank you, sir. David?
Well,
I'm making you Democrats too happy, so I've got to be very careful here before I go too much further.
Charlie, I tell you what, we could talk about this the rest of the show, but we'd never get to some of these primaries on the Republican side in Georgia. So we're going to move on from the T-Splost, and maybe we can either write its obituary or talk about how it made a huge comeback after Election Day. At least there's no runoff for it, since either yes or no, there's no maybe. And I tell you what, Catherine, if you don't mind, I'm going to skip over the second. I'm going to ask about the third, and that leaves you to either skip down to further or go back to the second in our plan to get through these as a team. But the reason, Charlie, I want to ask about the third is because I find it kind of intriguing that Lynn Westmoreland's a sitting congressman, multi-term. At one point was like one of the most powerful Republicans in the state legislature. Seems to have a lot of cachet, if you will. I thought was one time looking at running for governor would have been, you know, pretty powerful in that primary. Yet he has not one but two Republican challengers, and one of them's been on the Lamar County Commission. What has Lynn Westmoreland done wrong, or is it just that people are so eager to go to Congress?
If you're talking about Kingsley, I don't think he's been on the commission. I think he was a vice chairman of a local party, but I could be wrong on that. I haven't studied his background that closely, and I might be misremembering. So, but
yeah,
I don't
according
think
to
Paul Pickering,
says he was the county commission chair.
Okay,
from Lamar County.
That shows you how little attention I paid, frankly, to that race because I'm not worried about it. I don't think in this environment where you do have people that are just so aggravated with Washington, there is a huge anti-incumbency environment, and you can call it the Tea Party if you want. I don't like generalizing about what the Tea Party is because at this point the Tea Party can be many things to many people depending on who's using the term. But there definitely is a hold them all accountable, and we haven't gotten government fixed. And it goes back to, again, kind of some of the same problems that we have in the T-Splosk. If the rhetoric is we're going to stop government or we're going to stop the expansion of government, and 2 years later, people don't feel like it's expanded. They're ready to make a change. And so you'll have some people that feel that way. The reality of what I've observed with Congressman Westmoreland, and I've known Lynn, frankly, since before he was in politics. My family used to have a local hardware store in Fayetteville, Georgia, where he was a builder. So I've known him a long time, let's just put it that way to begin with. So I might be a little less than partial. But at the same point, there have been times where I've publicly challenged him, and that's documented. We won't go into it. So I still think I can give you a fair observation. Ben in Washington has been a congressman that has been able to work effectively between having one foot, shall you say, in the leadership/establishment camp and one foot in the outsider intransigent, call it Tea Party camp. And he does mix between the two very well. And there are times when if you're trying to see where the Republicans are going to go, if they're going to follow what you would call an establishment lead, or if they're going to follow a we've got to go more with the, you know, in modern terms, you're really almost calling it the John Boehner versus the Eric Cantor camp, but even Cantor is not even as far out as some of these guys. Watching Lynn will almost give you a bellwether of which side's going to win, because he tends to, as I've been told by some of his friends up there when I've asked how he's been able to gain a bit of it, he's got a good bit of quiet power for someone of his level of seniority in the House. He's only been there since 2004, which in terms of House careers really isn't that long, but he's earned a lot of respect because he does make up his mind quickly. Once he makes up his mind, he can tell you why he made up his mind and articulate it to his friends, and they can then determine, okay, Lynn's at least going here, and this is why, and they can make up their own. And so he's quickly become someone. I've seen that standing there in his office right before a vote was called, where a few others came in and asked us in my presence. But he is that kind of guy that is at least a good sounding board, and you can figure out where an issue might be going if you know where Lynn is. You know, he doesn't sit back, stick his finger to the wind. He makes up his own mind, and he'll go with it and let the chips fall where they may. And as far as getting two challengers, I don't frankly expect that when you see the votes counted that they're going to make that big of headway. I don't think, you know, Lynn's taking it as a serious campaign, but at the same point, I don't believe his strategists are pulling their hair out to try to make sure that, you know, they don't come up short and get into a runoff. Now, I think Lynn will be safe, but in this environment, I mean, you've got John Lewis being primary. You've got Phil Gingrey that has two challengers. You know, I think all it's actually, I haven't totaled the numbers, but I think the number that's out of the Georgia congressional group that doesn't have some kind of challenger really is about three or four, and a large number of them are on the primary side.
Okay,
hello.
Catherine, go ahead. We'll move across over to Catherine.
Well, I'm gonna jump around a little bit because I actually watched a little bit of the debates today on on TBS, and it was really funny because they had District 10, Paul Brown, a debate between him and Stephen Simpson, who's running against him, but it was funny because Brown wasn't there. So
there were quite a few debates today with empty podium, and
becoming
a pet peeve
really
of mine with Press Club, because they need to, okay, make the point that the person's not there, but pretending to ask questions to an empty podium and then rebutting the answer is kind of a little bit silly, shall we say.
Yeah, a little bit silly. It was pretty ridiculous. I was like, I thought, well, why don't they just call it a forum or something instead of a debate and just change the structure, but I think you're right. They were trying to point that out. But do you think that the Simpson guy is really giving Brown a run for the money, or what's the scoop
on
that?
In this case, no. If there was an incumbent that possibly could have been vulnerable to a primary challenge, I would have put Brown up there just on geography, because I think he kept right at about a third of his old district. Very much of that district is new to him. The part of the district that he really appeals to, a large part of it now, is in the new Georgia 9th district that doesn't have an incumbent up in extreme northeast Georgia. The folks around Lake Oconee area and down closer to Macon and into the Atlanta suburbs might not quite be as enamored with the voting style and shall we say the rigidity of Paul Brown. But at the end of the day, the challenger, as I understand it, the resident of Macon, doesn't really live in the district either. Decent man. I know people that know him, like him. But to take on an incumbent Republican congressman when your party, you know, has the speakership, you've really got to have a lot going for you other than being able to pay your qualifying fee and having some awareness of the political process. And so I really don't think that Congressman Brown's in trouble at all. I think had someone come out that had an elected background, that had a large fundraising machine, that one possibly could have been erased just because there was so much new geography involved. But at the same point, the governor, as I understand it, very early on, you know, put his arms around Brown and said, no, we're going to, you know, our network's behind you, essentially to keep Brown from running in the new 9th because so much of his old district was there. But at the end of the day, that was the one that maybe had some potential. But I really think that, you know, the two primaries going on the Republican side that have any traction at all are Georgia 9, because it's an open seat and a safe Republican seat, and then Georgia 12, where Barrow will have a credible challenger just out of the numbers alone. And that one, despite the fact that it's drawn to be very heavily Republican, should probably end up being a very interesting race to watch. I'm not ready to write Barrow out, despite the fact the numbers very much say it's a 60-40 Republican to Democrat district. The power of incumbency remains pretty powerful, and 12th is going to be the one to watch when we move to the general.
Okay, I'm going to give it back to Tim.
Okay, you just made an allusion to it, and so I want to jump right into it. To me, the most interesting-looking primary race has got to be there in the ninth. What's your take on how that thing's going?
Honestly, I can't find. I have not spent the time in the district like I did 2 years ago when the old ninth was taking up. I actually went to a lot of events and tried to figure that out, and pretty much decided that Tom Graves would probably do what he did, and really enjoyed getting to know the folks. A large part of that district is now the 14th district that I spent the time in, and I can't read it, so I'm not going to pretend to. I'll lay out what I think I see. Jim Galloway wrote this week that he thinks the third candidate, that I honestly can't even remember his name right now, but the one not named, Doug Collins and Martha Zoller, it makes it interesting to get into a runoff. And that's possible. I like Jim's rationale. I don't think the numbers are there, just extrapolating it from a straw poll standpoint, where he came in almost in a virtual, you know, third, a third, a third of the three, where I think Doug Collins won the straw poll. But, you know, that is very much a district, much like we just described with the T-Splosk, that outside of Hall County is going to be ultra-conservative, wants an outsider, whatever. And so the person that's not named and not at the top very well could get some traction, at least enough to kick into a runoff. At the end of the day, I think you do have a battle that is between Doug and Martha. And I think, you know, possibly you'll see the two of them in the runoff. I have no idea who's in the lead. No one's talking about their polling numbers on either side of the ones I've talked to. That's usually a sign that it's close enough that no one's trying to claim they're really ahead, because normally at this point you'd be trying to convince some others to get to your side with that. I just don't see folks really saying that they're going to win. And so you've got the choice between Doug Collins, who is, you know, being painted by his opponents as being the establishment guy. His record actually shows he can buck the establishment. He went against Speaker Richardson when he was in the House voting for a DOT board member, which is high inside baseball politics, but it cost people like Tom Graves and Doug Collins their offices in the Capitol. So, like I say, it's not something the retail voter ever sees, but if you understand what's going on, you do understand that's about as independent-minded as you can get. So he's got some upside there, despite the fact having the backing of the Speaker, the governor, I believe the lieutenant governor, and Bill Miller. So you've got a lot of old line traditional elected folks that have some stick in that area to help him. On the other side, you've got Martha, who is presenting herself as the outsider, but I look at her as the there's another form of insider. Martha has in her column, if you're going to go with the endorsement groups, Herman Cain, Eric Erickson, I can't remember, there's a conservative female PAC, name escapes me, but a few other, you know, it's not insider on the ground establishment, but it's kind of a Republican media-ish, you know, uber conservative PAC and or grassroots groups. And so, again, it's going to depend on what you mean by establishment, but they both have some pretty big guns to bring to the table. And who can actually translate that into real votes on the ground? It'll be an interesting battle, and I'm looking forward to, you know, that's the one you almost have to dissect after the fact to see what worked and what didn't. But it's, you know, you don't get just flat open Republican seats that often. And so the primary really is where the game is in that one. And it's a very Republican district. It'll be Republican forever. Whichever one of them wins can most likely be in that seat for you know, pretty much their entire career if they want. So long as they vote along with their constituents. And it's really going to be interesting to see which one of those two strategies pans out. But both very viable candidates, and I can't even begin to tell you which one of them's in the lead at this point.
All right, then. David?
Yeah, quick follow-up on that district. None of the candidates that ran last time, Lee Hawkins, or I believe there's another one, incredible candidate, they didn't try to seek that seat when it came up. And, again, why not?
Lee, as I understand, it's running for state rep. And so that, from what I have been told, I won't pretend to know him well, but he ran, you know, there were four races within a roughly 100-day period last time that he lost, because there was the special election and the special election runoff. That elected Graves to Congress, but immediately they were in the general primary, of which Graves won with Hawkins in a runoff again, and then Hawkins lost the runoff. That'll take a lot out of you, win or lose. And getting up, you know, wanting to do that again, going back to the same group of people, asking them to put money in, putting your own money in, putting your time in for something where the governor has pretty much already come out with his handpicked person out of Gainesville. You then have Martha Zoller, also out of Hall County, with the name ID associated with being on a very conservative talk radio station slash program for years. You've got to ask yourself, if you're Lee Hawkins, you know, after what you've just been through, you really want to fight as an underdog to break through and get into that, or in his case where the maps were drawn as such, where he had an opportunity to go to the Georgia General Assembly, and I was told by several people that knew him well that he really missed being in the Senate, that, you know, he was, I don't want to say half-hearted about going for Congress, but he really liked being at the Georgia General Assembly. And he thought that might be where he'd really rather be. And so the opportunity for an open house seat versus going you know, to try for Congress again after going through what he went through in his past campaign, I think he probably chose what was best for him, and certainly what is probably the shorter mountain to climb.
Okay. Well, and let's do the last house seat that we'll tackle, even though there's some token opposition here and there. And that's 12. You alluded to it. It would be in a very competitive race, but give us a fuller breakdown.
Once again, I'm not even going to try to guess who's in the lead. There's four candidates. Three of them are from the Augusta area. One is Columbia County, which is suburban Augusta, that has a larger percentage of Republican votes, and the other two that are from, as I understand it, Richmond County, which also has, I think Tim Galloway again pointed out this week, a Democratic sheriff race going on. And that'll suck up a lot of crossover votes, because sheriff's races tend to bring out very high voter turnout of people of all parties. And so that basically gives Lee Anderson a little bit of possible. He currently elects as a state rep out of Columbia County from Grovetown. In the debates, it looks like Allen and Wright McLeod, Rick Allen. There are two Rick Allens running, by the way. There's also a Rick Allen running in the Georgia 2nd District, so that confuses quite a few of us on the Republican side every time we see a name pop up on a press release. But Rick Allen of Augusta, along with Wright McLeod of Augusta, seem to be the top two that have been slinging it out thus far in the debates. I definitely don't count Anderson out. And then you have Maria Sheffield of Mableson, Cobb County, but now is claiming deep roots in Dublin and is using Dublin as her address, although you don't have to live in the district to run. But she is gained, from what I understand, a bit of Tea Party support from some of the Tea Party groups in the southern end of the district. But most of the folks I'm talking to are looking at it really as a race of two of those first three. But in a four-person race, there are so many ways you can divide it. And, again, there's just no clear front runner and no one sharing the polling numbers. It tells me that we may very well just be flipping coins on election night in a couple weeks, and we'll – you know, figure out which two are going in a runoff, but I don't see any way possible that one goes without a runoff.
Yes. Well, that was excellent on the congressional coverage. I will tell you, we've got about 7 minutes left, we think. We could end up with more. And, of course, your insights are valuable. We'll take as much as we can get. But we'll start moving into maybe some of the hotter state House and state Senate races. We obviously couldn't begin to cover them all. But one I got to ask you about, and I'm going to ask you more about a dynamic than I guess am the actual race, and that's up here in the 52nd district where I live at in Rome. Even if you're not familiar with David Doss and Tuck Huffstetler, there's another candidate running as well. It's more the dynamic that's been created. David Doss was a democratically supported member of the Transportation Board.
supported Roy Barnes in, I guess, all four campaigns for governor, even the most recent one. He's running as a Republican. He had switched parties right towards the end of his time on the Transportation Board, and he's been attacked as not a true Republican. Well, Chuck Hufstetler had been on the county commission as a Republican, but it's been seen that he's voted in some Democratic primaries, and Herman Cain has weighed in, and he's supporting David Doss, even with the Democratic past. Do you see more and more of this where it seems like in the Republican primary, it's not so much about issues or qualifications, it's just who can be the most Republican, and is this a good thing for Republican politics?
Well, it goes back to, I think we spoke about it in one of my last visits, where at this point we are a one-party state, period. And there was a time where when you went into politics, it didn't matter if you were conservative or slightly less than conservative. If you wanted to be have a seat at the table, you were a Democrat. And 10 years later, back when I was recruiting candidates, I was told that many times, why are you a Democrat? We need you to be a Republican. Well, you know, if I'm going to have a career, I've got to be a Democrat. Now it's 180 degrees different. The exact same people that used to be good Democrats are now good Republicans. And as you say, it's really not about policy. And at the state level, frankly, you know, the party talking points don't seem to matter. I mean, on bringing T-Splash back in, you've got the exact same people that are railing against national programs for infrastructure, for economic recovery, telling us that we have to vote for T-Splash because it's immediate jobs and a jolt in the arm, and that's why we have to vote for it. And these exact same people, when it comes up at a national level, will be telling us it's horrible because Democrats want to use Keynesian economics to get the economy moving. There is such a cognitive dissonance right now between what's said at the state level and what's done at the national level that it pretty much shows that partisan politics really is about a team sport right now. It's not about ideology. It's not about philosophy. It's really about us versus them, and that, I see that on both sides. So to get to that race specifically, yes, Doss, I know, was a very powerful member of the DOT board. I don't know the specific dynamics of that race at all. What I would be watching for is there was a essentially a spur freeway to go from, I believe, Cartersville at I-75 into Rome several years ago, and David Doss was the one that was accused of holding it up for a DOT board vote for something. That came out public, and I'm just kind of curious as to, with T-Splash being such an issue and him being on the DOT board, how is that going to affect that Senate district and the vote would be what I would have been looking for. But as I said, I have not. That one's kind of out of my media market, and I've been kind of covered up in the races. I generally pick and choose a few that interest me at the surface level, and that one just has never really hit my radar to figure out what's going on the ground. So anything I add to it would just kind of be wild guessing as opposed to any kind of real insight.
Yes, and you're talking about the direct access from 411 to 75. Honestly, I think one of us would have a better chance of going over the Red Sea and spreading our arms and having it parked and actually getting that road finished. We had the chair of the Transportation Committee was the representative from Rome for a decade in that spot and never could get done, and I just don't know what would get it done. Well, I'm going to pass it to Catherine. Now, I may have to break in if we get our other guests calling in, but we're going to keep you on the line as long as we can, Charlie. Catherine, any primaries you've had from the Republicans more in the Atlanta area or somewhere else for that matter? Catherine? I'm going to pass it to Tim real quick so we don't have a lot of dead air.
Okay. Charlie, I'm actually going to ask you about something down in the Atlanta area. You know, we all saw how redistricting went on the state Senate level, you know, in the metro area and Fulton County in particular. So I got to ask, have the two words Milton County come up in any conversations in any elections down that way?
It's not so much in the elections, but it's definitely – again, it affects T-Splash. It affects the attitudes. When you've got there's a city of Brookhaven vote, which is in northern central DeKalb County, if you will, just north of the city of Atlanta, for those of you unfamiliar with it. But yes, trying to figure out how to break away and how to re-slice and dice. What is a region? How are we going to work together versus how do we not get governed by some people? It's all there in the mix. I don't see Milton being specifically used. But what you have and the Senate district race that's going to affect that most directly is Senate District 6, which is now goes from Cobb County into northern Atlanta Buckhead. And that will determine essentially whether or not the Fulton County delegation has majority Republicans. And assuming that one of the three Republicans running in that primary is able to take that seat, then you basically have, for local legislation coming out of Fulton County, a much easier path to, if not create Milton County, because that still is going to require some level of constitutional amendment or consolidation of two other counties, because our number of counties are capped constitutionally at 159, you could still have local legislation that would essentially force Fulton County to do different things as a county government, such as turn more things over to municipalities, essentially get rid of the county structure and force everything into municipalities. And so what you're really looking at and what the strategy coming out of this election is, what happens in that state Senate district is going to have a long way to go of whether or not you need a Milton County, or if everything is just kind of, if you can't get the constitutional amendment, if you essentially break up Fulton County just by pushing all governance into the municipalities and taking powers away from the county themselves.
Okay. David?
Yes, well, Catherine, we'll come back to you if you're there. And
I'm here. I was actually going to ask the exact same question that Tim asked.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I had my phone on mute. It's fine. It's good. Yeah. We're all good.
Well, let's just, Charlie, I'll ask you kind of a closing question, whether or not we have a call pushing your way or not. Are there any competitive Republican primaries, state House, state Senate, that we hadn't mentioned? They're really going to be exciting to watch on election night.
Let's see. The one I've spent the most time with at that level is the one I just mentioned in House District. I'm sorry, Senate District 6. You've got one out of the Columbus area where Kip Smith is a bit vulnerable. He's the son of former DOT Transportation Commissioner Vance Smith, being challenged by John Piesold. If I'm pronouncing that properly, that's out of the Harris County area, just north of Columbus. And I think that one has some real competitiveness to it. I'm also really interested to see what happens on the House-Senate side. The Senate caucus, by transferring all their money into the incumbent protection thing, probably made the race, just aggravated more people than not. I think the vast majority of the Senate incumbents are probably okay. The one I'm really watching there, Bill Heath, is probably in a little bit of trouble, but right now it's going to be closer than he'd like. But if I was looking at an incumbent that's in trouble, I'd start with Heath. Seeing the percentage of the vote that Chip Rogers gets, who's the sitting Senate Majority Leader, but has just had issue after issue after issue the last few years. But he's one of the ones that, basically as leader put this T-Splos thing together and is now running against it as hard as he can. And it's going to be really interesting to see how that works and plays out in Cherokee County. His opponent, Brandon Beach, is very much for T-Splos, and were that not the case, I'd probably be really more interested in watching to see how that comes out. I think Chip ultimately is okay, but I'm interested just to see what that final vote total is there. Other Senate district races, I'm looking at Jack Murphy versus Steve Voschall. That's Forsyth County, just north, due north of, it's Forsyth County, up Georgia 400, I'm trying to say, north of Fulton. There again, Murphy's had some issues. He's the chairman of the banking committee that's being sued by the FDIC for gross negligence and breach of fiduciary duty for his role as director of a bank. I don't know that incumbency is just the rules we have here. It is just so difficult to take out an incumbent. But I'm really thinking most of the Senate incumbents are okay. Kip Smith, probably the one that, might have the biggest target on his head in the House. And there are a few others, I'm sure, but that's off the top of my head. That's kind of what I'm thinking, and that's really what I'm looking at.
Yeah. Well, Charlie, we thank you again for coming on. I don't know if you know this, but up until 2 weeks ago, when you were on with us about 16 months ago, it was like December, January, sometime in there, it was the highest rated episode, most listens we ever had, and one finally passed it. And we think the combination of the little bit of a hot streak we're on as far as the ratings lately, and you together will probably set a new record for tonight's show.
Well, I wish you the best with that, and I guess I'll just have to say that maybe they'll need better guests than me, because good luck to you. But,
well,
y'all do good stuff here, even though, like I say, ideologically, we're on the other side of the aisle most of the times, but I appreciate y'all's commitment to do this regularly once a week and just foster the debate and keep it going. So y'all keep at it, and much more success continue to you.
And you
guys, thank you, sir.
All right, y'all have a great day.
You too.
Yeah, well, for the folks that usually tune in and hear a lot of national stuff and you're thinking, where'd all the national talk go? Let's get into some of that now. And if our guest is calling, great. If it's another week, it's another week. Well, nationally, a lot of talk, probably the most in months, about George W. Bush. I could talk about the poll that shows people, and I put it on our Facebook page, talking about people still blame him more for the economy than President Obama by good numbers. But more interesting than that, both Bushes. First, George H.W. Bush said he would not attend the Republican convention. Obviously, with his advanced age, you could say, hey, travel's probably not always easiest at that age. But then George W. Bush said he's not going to the Republican convention. That means the Republican convention will have no former presidents at it, which is probably a rarity for conventions. You probably have to go back to some Democratic conventions around the turn of the century or what have you, maybe right before Grover Cleveland was in office, to find that dynamic happening. Tim, how big a deal is this?
Well, I think it's actually a pretty big deal. And if I had to guess, David, I would say that even though Governor Romney would never say it or admit to it, he's probably breathing a little bit of a sigh of relief. Because the president, of course, would have commanded a prime time speaking slot at the convention. And, you know, it would have reminded people all over again, perhaps, of why they voted Democratic to start with in 2008. But what Mitt Romney ended up with, here's the best of both worlds. The invitation was issued, apparently, to President Bush, and he declined, citing this and that and the other reason. So it just says, you know, he was grateful for the invitation. He supports Governor Romney, but he's enjoying his time off the political stage, blah, blah, blah. So I'd say it was a good day for Mitt Romney, David.
Yes. Now, Catherine, don't you think that that invitation actually had a post-it note stuck on it saying,
yes,
climb this? What do you think?
Oh, be nice.
Well, I suspect that there were, you know, phone calls and emails and texts going around saying, well, you know, you really don't want to come, you know. It's going to be hot wherever. Where is their convention in Florida?
Tampa. Hey, it's the beach.
Yes.
I mean, everybody loves the beach around this time of year. Come on.
My question is Jeff going to be there? And is he going to get a keynote slot?
Yeah, you'd think he'd have to be, given that he was the Florida governor. And
he will be there. He will be there.
In Florida.
Yes.
Yeah.
He will be there.
So it could be, I mean, it could be that the Georgias were like, let's give Jeb a chance to, you know, have the spotlight. Or that could be their, that could be their excuse anyway. The interesting thing that I saw this week, it may have been last week, because I have no internet at home and I haven't for almost 2 weeks, which fortunately I have a 3G iPad, but whatever, was I saw that a headline that Sarah Palin had not been invited by the Romney campaign to come to the convention, which she was, you know, of course, had her nose out of joint about that for some reason. I wonder what the plan is for the convention. You know, I mean, you know, you're right that, you know, George Bush would either one of them would, you know, grab the spotlight. But, you know, it is a convention, and you want to have some excitement. So I'm curious to see what they're going to do if they're not going to have any of these sort of, you know, shiny Republicans.
Well, I know what they're going to do. Kid Rock and the two remaining members of Lynyrd Skynyrd are going to play a full set list. You know, we talked about that the whole thing. Maybe they'll have Jesse Jackson, since they don't have bushes there. He can say, Republicans, you've wised up your stage and out of the bushes. So, I mean, I don't know. Some of their big heavy hitters definitely are gone to have in there. I mean, you know, you think since McCain lost last time, they're not going to want to have him. So you're right. It's like, will they have enough star power to even attract people on national coverage? Now, obviously, news junkies are going to watch on Fox, CNN, and MSNBC, although I doubt there'll be much on MSNBC for the Republican convention. Tim?
I'm going to predict that Chris Christie will keynote the thing. What do you think?
I thought they announced that, didn't they?
Did they?
Or was it just a rumor?
Yeah, they announced that. So that means he's not going to be the vice presidential candidate.
Yeah.
I mean, and really the keynote address is usually somebody that's not that known, but they think has power. Bill Clinton in 1988, Barack Obama in 2004. I mean, it's reserved for somebody a lot of times, unless it's a really speaker that, you know, they know is going to do well, like Zell Miller did in 92. So a lot of things to think about there. Well, let's move on to another topic. Once again, presidential politics. In June, President Obama's campaign spent more than they took in. Now, on the surface, that looks bad. But now one thing you have to think about, and I don't know what their plan was, but campaigns are different than your monthly budget. I mean, obviously, in your monthly budget, you pretty much always want to take in as much or more than you spend. But in a campaign, you have early on months in which you don't spend a whole lot. You still take in a lot of low-hanging fruit. Then you have all that war chest saved up, and you spend more of it as the campaign goes on. Now, the one thing I don't know, because I don't want to just be a false defender of the president's campaign, I don't know what their plan was for June. Were they planning to spend more in June or break even in June, or were they planning on June helping build the surplus for later than the campaign? Because obviously if this was supposed to be building the surplus up, this is a bad thing. Catherine, when you saw the story, what did you make of it?
You know, I have to tell you that I am so fed up with this money. I mean, I can't believe that they spend $143 million. I think it was $143 million in a month. And, you know, what how much do we have to show for it? I mean, I haven't seen any of it. Of course, we're in Georgia. I was in Michigan over the weekend and into the week, and I saw a lot of political advertisements, a lot more than we see here. But I just think that it's ridiculous. I mean, I just can't think of anything else but that it's just ridiculous sums of money. And I guess I don't really care, honestly. I think that they should spend less money. I think this in times like this, when people are struggling and it just seems awfully luxurious to be spending this kind of money on campaigns. I don't mean to be a downer about it, but it just bugs me.
Yeah, and I don't want to talk about every money story either. I mean, I think sometimes you look at political journalism and it's money, money, money. This article just was a more interesting one. So, I mean, every once in a while, it's just
It's hard to talk about politics without talking about all this money. I think ultimately, it's, you know, probably even. You know, it's always better if they're raising more money. I mean, I always feel like it's better for the Democrats if they're raising more money, because then they have more money going further into the campaign. But, you know, if they felt like they needed to spend that money in June, there were a lot of activities going on that they felt like they needed to support. Of course, it was Pride Month, so they spent a lot of money on Pride activities around the country, which I'm sure was a sizable chunk of it. So I don't know that it's good, bad, or otherwise. I'm sure that, I mean, I think there's a lot of concerns about the money on the Democratic side because all these, you know, super PACs on the Republican side are raising so much money, but I'm just a little frustrated, I guess, by all
although
this money.
Although, Catherine, you kind of scared me there. If you're meaning Pride, you mean, you know, gay rights, gay vote. If they spent the lion's share of the money on a voting block that is somewhere between 5 and 10% of the population, now, of course, there's Kinsey studies you can argue about on that, that probably is already overwhelmingly Democratic, and even more so after the president's announcement, that's kind of a scary thought. If they,
well, I don't know how much money they spent, but June is Pride Month, so in everywhere but in Georgia, they had big Pride events. So, and the president has made a lot of, there's a lot of effort put into, you know, making sure that the messaging to the LGBT community is very clear and very forceful. So I'm not saying they spent all their money on that. I'm not saying that at all, but I'm sure that there was an uptick in their expenses related to that.
Now, well, I mean, I hope it's not even a big share, because if you're having to campaign to your base, and a base that's, you know, no more than 10% of the population, that's, doesn't seem like a real sound strategy to me. Tim, what's your
overall story? When you work in the LGBT community, you're not only reaching LGBT citizens, you're also reaching allies, family, and that's much more than 10%. So you got to be clear about that.
I would agree that's more. But isn't that people that probably are on your side anyway? I mean, it's the preacher turning around and facing the choir. I mean, that's the
biggest
point,
how much of that do we do? I mean, we do that anyway. We do that all the time. Anyway,
yeah, and
that's a whole other conversation.
We need to try to grow the flock, if you will, get new folks, because once we get a bunch of new folks in, then we'll have this thing locked down. And the Republicans obviously are trying to do the same thing. They're trying to grow the flock, and they can have the thing locked down. Tim, what's your thoughts on the overall article?
Well, look, here's the facts that we know. The Obama campaign has already spent $100 million on TV commercials in the battleground states. $1 in every five, by the way, has been spent in the state of Ohio. Number two in that money dip is Florida, and Virginia is third. Now, that is not by accident. Three-fourths of the ads that the Obama campaign has put out there have been negative ads, attack ads. And what they're simply trying to do in these battleground states is go ahead and define Mitt Romney before Mitt Romney has a chance to do that himself. It's similar, I guess, to I'm going to use the word swift voting, even though that's not exactly what they're doing. But you recall that's what happened to John Kerry in 2004 before he could catch his breath after he secured the nomination. He was defined in a way that he could not come back from. If you look at the electoral math, I mean, let's face it, David, Mitt Romney cannot win the presidency or anything near it if he loses Ohio, Virginia, and Florida. I'd say if he loses any two of those three, he's done. So it's about electoral math, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and there's other scenarios, states in which they can look at. But now one thing I will say, and this piggybacks on a topic we talked about last week, where the president said, well, you know, Texas is not a battleground state yet, but we're working on that. If we don't have money, it'll be tough to try to push the envelope in some of these emerging battleground states like Arizona, Texas, Georgia, South Carolina, and I would love to have the funds to try to see if we could expand the map in the future.
Yeah,
where it goes.
Let me add this. The advantage in the fall from top to bottom will be with the Republicans. And in some of these down ballot races, people like the Koch brothers and Karl Rove and some of these people, they're going to make a lot of difference in some of these races. And it could be a very good election night for the GOP in Senate and House races, even though they might lose the presidential race. I could easily see that happening, couldn't you?
If they know how to paint the corners with some of this outside money. And the article did make that point, too, that outside money was huge. Well, Catherine, it was great to have you back on the show this week on the Coastal Vine.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks again to Charlie Harper. And until next Sunday, in which I think we've already got one of our guests booked, ZJ Hafez, who came in last year, last cycle, I should say, running for Florida State House, is going to be one of our guests next week on the Kudzu Vine.
Okay. Good night, guys.
Good night, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity?